cosmic bubble conditions. And so I'm going to tell you, first of all, why we would be interested in that question, why we might think we should have a chance of seeing them. What we would see if, in fact, there are such collisions in our past lifetime. And finally, how likely it is that these collisions are there. That's obviously a hard question. I think I can claim some connection to holography in this talk. I'm not sure that Ben emphasized this yesterday, but the theory that he discussed, this putative conformal field theory, one way to obtain it is by looking at the asymptotic sky of an observer who lives in a Minkowski bubble. So that sky is a two-sphere, and it's tiled with the effects of these bubble collisions. And the distribution that Ben started with is the distribution of those bubble collisions on that sky. So when we look at cosmology today, perhaps we could use that CFT as a way to compute the, for example, temperature fluctuations in the same medium that we expect to see. And since we're observers who live at finite time, we're not really observing a CFT. We're observing a CFT in the middle of some kind of RG flow. So it's not really conformal. But at least in some models, it might be a good approximation.
So all these bubble collisions appear the same in the sky?
No, they don't all appear the same. But there's a distribution of them which has this conformal invariance. So they're different sizes and models, et cetera. Distributions are not.
Even when you have different types of bubbles?
Yeah, each type will have its own conformal invariance. So this is based on bunch of recent work and some work in progress that I'll briefly describe, and work by lots of other people that I learned very much of this from. Lots of many who were in the room. So okay, here's a obligatory slide showing W map and some galaxies and so the point I want to make here is just that cosmology really has become a precision science of sorts in the last decade of years, which really wasn't true in the past. And that presents us with an opportunity which is really unique. So if we want to study high-end physics, normally we build a particle accelerator, we build experiments, etc. But that only gets us so far. If we can compute and understand cosmological observables at sufficient precision, we can use that as a kind of giant accelerator, because the one place that we know high-energy physics was very important was in the early universe. And so that's really a unique opportunity. And if you're going to try to make use of that opportunity, you have to think about physics of inflation, because inflation is kind of both your enemy and your friend in this regard. It's your enemy because you might be interested in what state you started with. What was the Big Bang? Or the Big Bang, if anything. And inflation shields you from finding out about that. It inflates away signatures of that. But on the other hand, it does that in a very high-energy way. So the energy scale of inflation was probably very high. And so that opens an opportunity. You could look for effects of high-energy physics on inflationary physics, so things that took place during inflation. Or you could hope that inflation was relatively short, in which case there might still be some remnants of the initial state left over. And actually, in this talk, I'm talking about this second possibility, that there's still some remnants of that initial state that we might be able to see. Okay, so I want to make a claim just to convince you that this might be a useful way to proceed, which is that string theory is actually both falsifiable and predictive. There's an asterisk there, and there's going to be a footnote, which will be too small to read. But there's a plan. So you have to make some assumptions. So here they are. So the first assumption is that we can describe the string landscape and just a lot of the features of it using an effective field theory with sort of scalars. Now these assumptions are, what's in black is sort of the conservative assumption, and what's in green is how we could relax it. So it's not necessarily true that we have to do that, it's just the easiest thing. And so that's actually the framework that we work in, but I think it is possible go beyond that. We have to assume that origin of the universe began in a state with large vacuum energy, and that's not what we live in. We don't live in a state with large vacuum energy, so there had to be some transition that took us to the state we're in now. If the universe simply began in whatever room we live in, I don't think there's much one could say. It's not the case techniques. And the final assumption is a technical one that I'm going to use in order to study a certain set of instantons, which is that the transition that took us from this high-energy state to our current state was mediated by an instanton of a sort of foreign variance. And again, this can be relaxed But it's generally true that that at least in these low energy effective field theories, the dominant inciton has that invariant. It's the most symmetric possible inciton, and so it has the
you don't believe that an upward fluctuation is possible? So the universe could have started in this vacuum and then.
That would actually be okay. Yeah, that would be okay. Okay, so if these assumptions are correct, the region of the universe that we inhabit has certain very special characteristics. In particular, it can't have positive curvature. And so an observation of positive curvature would be a disconfirmation of this. So it's most likely an open universe, although maybe that the curvature is so small that you can't distinguish it from flat. And furthermore, if this is correct, other bubbles are at least eventually going to collide with the one we live in. It may not have happened yet, so we may not be able to see them. But with probability one, there will be actually an infinite number of such collisions in our future, and perhaps some of them are in our past. Okay, so I'm going to use this effective field theory. What kind of effective field theory should I be studying? So the kind of effective field theory we would expect from string theory is one with many scalar fields as well as many other non-scalar fields. Some quite complicated potential for these scalars that has an enormous number of local minima. And then within this energy landscape, tunneling can take you from one room to another. And I just wanted to make one point about this, which is that there's nothing particularly special about this in the sense that any theory with extra dimensions is going to have 4D scalars, because at least if the metric is of a product form, four-dimensional space plus something else, then the fields that describe shapes or motions in those extra dimensions are four-dimensional scalars. They don't transform under 4D Lorentz transformations. So there's always going to be a lot of scalars if you have a complex theory that's not extremely simple, and there's in more dimensions than just four. So it's actually not surprising that this comes out. And in fact, you don't even need extra dimensions. Many purely four-dimensional theories have first-order phase transitions, which are described by the kind of bubble nucleation I'm talking about, with some scalar order parameter, some effective field theory on the scalar. Okay, so having said that we should study a model with many scalars, I'm going to study a model with one. It's easier. So here's a potential for one scalar. And the special thing about this particular potential is that it has the feature that it can reproduce just about everything we've observed in large-scale cosmology, much less some couplings that haven't written down to the standard model and so on. So there's some high-energy pulse vacuum up there. There's a tunneling event, which tunnels through this barrier, produces a region. If this is a slope that's appropriate for slow roll, there will be a period of slow roll inflation with some number n equal to inflation. And then at the end, you'll settle down at this minimum that has some tiny positive vacuum energy that would explain dark energy that we see today. Now, when this tunneling event occurs, I'm going to describe how it looks. It produces a universe with a particular set of characteristics, as I said. But there's always this caveat that if n is very large, the special features of that initial state get wiped away, and you end up with something that's indistinguishable from a flat FRW cosmology. So that's always a caveat we should bear in mind. This number default should not be too much larger than the minimum that's required. Okay, so what kind of instanton creates this bubble? So this was studied by Coleman and Lucha, and probably most people in the audience are familiar with this, so I won't spend a lot of time going over it. But what you do is you look for a solution, you put the equations of motion around the false vacuum where you start. And then you look for a special type of solution, actually, one that has an imaginary part that has a negative mode. So there's an imaginary part and the one with the determinant. And then that gives an imaginary part to free energy, which just means there's an instability in terms of the k-channel. So one such solution, which has an SO4 invariance, takes this form. This is an S3, so that gives you the SO4 invariance. Psi is some angle on this thing that has a topology of a force here. And so the metric depends on one function, a psi. The field depends also just on that coordinate. And so this has an SO4 invariance. It's one of the types of instantons I mentioned. It looks something like that. It's topologically a sphere, but with a radius that varies as you move along these longitude lines from one pole to the other. People often consider the thin wall limit, although that's not necessary. That's not necessary for anything I'm going to say, but it's simple to consider the thin wall limit where the radius changes abruptly. So this is a sort of a kink. And if you want to find the Lorentzian solution that results from this transition, so if you want to know what kind of spacetimes this creates, you can simply analytically continue the solution around a point of symmetry, a point where the derivative of the restrictive psi is zero. You continue psi to it, and that gives you this Lorentzian metric, which you'll recognize as an open Friedmann-Rumsfeld-Auger cosmology. So this is hyperbolic three space, constant negative curvature space. A is now some function of time, so it's the hyperbolic scale factor. And the scalar field is just a function of that time. So physically what this says is that the bubble that's produced has a particular slicing, which is this t coordinate, along which the energy density is constant. In other words, it's an FRW cosmology because that slicing is homogeneous and isotropic. And it's an open slicing. So this is a little bit bizarre because from one point of view, this is a finite bubble. You can slice it with these kind of slices along which the energy density is not constant, but in which the bubble has a finite size. It appears with some radius and then expands. Nevertheless, even though from that point of view it's finite, there's another slicing, which is perfectly valid, in which its volume is infinite. And the reason it's infinite is that the bubble expands forever, and those slices go up into these corners where it's been expanding for a long time. So the slices on which it's homogeneous have infinite volume. So this really seems to create an infinite universe, even though it's a finite action instanton, and it only occupies the finite part of the space at the moment it appears in this slice. Now, normally when you have a big bang, regardless of what the spatial curvature is, there's a singularity at t equals zero. And one thing that's interesting to note about these solutions is that there's no singularity at t equals zero. If you want, you can think of that as an exception to the singularity theorems, which arises from the fact that these initial conditions are very non-generic. So if you were to start at a later time and run the universe back, if you didn't change anything and ran it back, you'd have a completely smooth solution. T equals zero is this red light up here. You'd have a completely smooth solution there with no curvature divergence. But if you changed anything even a little bit and then ran back, you would have depends on what you changed, but in general, you would have a singularity there.
It's an open set.
Sorry?
It's an open set, which is right.
It's an open set, which is regular, actually, yes. But for example, if you were to change the density... Yes, it is, actually. Yeah. But if you were to change the density in a homogeneous way, so you make it slightly larger, and then run back, then you would have a singularity. It's an open set because you can, of course, have a perturbation which existed here before, which just goes straight up through there, and that obviously doesn't cause any problems. So it's certainly an open set, but it's not open in homogeneous perturbations that extend all the way up to infinity on these open slices. Okay, so suppose we have this kind of universe. We can ask, what could we detect? What are the cosmological observables that would tell us that we live in it? And one of them already mentioned, which is spatial curvature. So here are a set of features of these bubble cosmologies. So the most sort of obvious feature is that it's open, it has negative spatial curvature. Now, when these bubbles first appear, they're quite homogeneous generally because fluctuations around the symmetric state cost action. So they're generally quite homogeneous, and they're very curved when they appear. In fact, they're dominated by negative curvature. So if you didn't have a period of inflation inside the bubble after it appeared, you would immediately go to some matter of a radiation-dominated phase where your curvature dominated. And once your curvature dominated, you remain curvature dominated forever because it redshifts more slowly than matter radiation. So in a bubble universe like this that doesn't have any inflation, you're always curvature dominated. And when you're dominated by negative curvature, structure doesn't form because negative curvature is like an expansion. It's a bit faster than would be in a flat universe and prevents overdensities from collapsing. So you don't have any structure in a universe like that. No stars, no galaxies. And so there's a pretty decent anthropic argument that you have to have inflation if we're going to live in one of these bubble universes. And the amount of inflation you need is roughly the same amount you need to solve the flatness problem. So you need the curvature to be no larger than of order 1 on Hubble scales today during the year when structure is formed.
So I'd just like to check in about where you stand relative to these measure issues. It sounds like you're actually trying to just carve out a little space to talk about something in the voids of it. So for example, if I wanted to try to predict how much inflation I would expect, et cetera, how strong the signatures would be. You're just saying, let's try to back off from that and look at a more concrete problem.
Yeah, that's pretty much
cool.
Much. I'll come back at the end to asking how probable it is that we'll observe collisions, but yeah.
What kind of, if you have this reasonably short period of potential, what kind of state are you going to have into?
So again,
if I exit from a false vacuum into a period of inflation, do you exit into a bunch of baby vacuum?
You're asking after the inflation or when you first appear?
When you first appear and start inflating, because you have a short period of inflation. So that's.
Yeah, so you're in a well-defined state that you can find by, so the equivalent instant time has a unique state on it.
Right.
Euclidean solution. So you can whip rotate that, and that gives you a state, which is not exactly the bunch data state. So it depends a bit on the tunneling, so kind of on the shape of the barrier and so on. And it does have some interesting features in it, but they tend to get inflated away rather rapidly.
Right, but if you had it, I mean, if you can see curvature, presumably your period of inflation is short enough. So.
Yeah, so you can ask what the perturbation spectrum would look like at large scales, and that's an answerable question, but it's model dependent. Depends a bit on the shape of the barrier. But yeah, exactly. So that's what I meant here. So there's some particular spectrum of density perturbations, which in principle you can see at large scales, but it would be too large to see there. Okay, so it is, at least with this set of assumptions, it is falsifiable and predictive. And, the caveat that applies particularly to this, that a lot of inflation makes it very difficult to distinguish from anything else with a lot of inflation. Okay, so that's pretty much what you can say about single model cosmology. But as I mentioned before, it was shown, I think, by Ruth and Weinberg, long ago, that these bubbles form clusters, and they form infinite clusters. So in other words, you can think of it this way. The bubble forms, it's surrounded on all sides by false vacuum. And since there's some event which produced the bubble, it can happen again. It will happen again if you wait long enough. And since there's false vacuum surrounding this bubble, it will happen in that false vacuum eventually. If it happens close enough, those two bubbles will collide. It's again surrounded by false vacuum. Again, if another bubble nucleus will collide with that group of two and group of three and so on. So a cluster builds up, and unless something cuts it off, it builds up to an infinite number of bubbles in it. So that means there's, at any given time, in one of these bubbles, some number of these collisions in the past lifetime of somebody living at that time.
If the false vacuum is at a much higher energy, wouldn't this happen rather rarely? I mean, the new bubble would have to be very close to the bubble we're in
order. It has to be within a Hubble wave, right? A false vacuum Hubble.
Yeah.
We'll come to the number. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily happen rarely because the bubble can get very big and have a large surface area. But we'll talk about that. Okay, so when one of these collisions happens, so what happens when there's one of these collisions? So here's a very schematic diagram. I'll have a slightly more realistic one in a moment. So there's two bubbles. There's metastable false vacuum there before. You can always choose coordinates in a two-bubble collision where they appear at the same time, although you don't have to. And so then you have a region, which is sort of bubble A, region which is bubble B. At this moment, they collide. They collide along a hyperboloid. You take this open slicing. And there's a domain wall between them, so long as they correspond to different vacua. So if the scalar field and this effective potential has a different value here than it does here, then there must be a domain wall that separates the two. It's generally pretty thin, although, again, this is a bit model dependent. And so this domain wall will do something. There's a pressure on it, and it tends to accelerate one way or the other. In other words, it gets pushed into the left bubble or it gets pushed into the right bubble. And there's some energy that's released at this collision, so there's some pulse of radiation which flies into both bubbles and affects everything inside this light cone. So this is the light cone of the collision. Now, you can actually find analytic solutions that describe this. The reason that's possible, and this was first noticed by Hawking, Watson, and Stewart, I think, the reason it's possible is that there's an extra symmetry. So when two black holes merge, there's not much symmetry, and it's extremely difficult to find a solution. When two bubbles merge, because there's a boost invariance of these bubbles, the SO4 of the instanton turns into an SO3,1, two bubbles merging breaks that to an SO2,1, which has three generators, and that's enough for there to be kind of Birkhoff theorem. It's as many symmetry generators as a single black hole has. So there's a unique solution to this, which you can find analytically if you're in a space that's dominated by cosmological constants, just like you can find an ADS Schwarzschild solution. So anyway, you can write down analytic solutions, and you have to make an approximation, which is that the space everywhere is dominated by vacuum energy. if the space is, say, radiation dominated inside one of these bubbles, you can't find a solution. It's as hard as finding a black hole solution. Never done these, so it's difficult. You could find it in America. But anyway, you can find an analytic solution, at least in this, approximation. And then you can study what happens to the domain wall that appears between these two. So here's a slightly more realistic picture. So we still have these two bubbles colliding. This is the one that we're in, let's say. So we live on some co-moving geodesic of the open FRW cosmology that's inside here. And so there's a couple of parameters that are important here. One of them is, I said there's always a coordinate system for two bubble collisions where they appear at the same moment, but then there's no reason to expect the observer to be at rest in that coordinate system. And so beta, you can think of as the boost with respect to the guy who is at rest. So we're on this geodesic, it's boost beta with respect to that coordinate system. And there's some moment in time when we come inside this future lifetime of this collision, and that moment in time is determined partly by beta and partly by the separation distance between these two. If they appear very close, then close together, then the collision happens very early. If they appear almost a Hubble length apart, the pulse back to Hubble length apart, it takes them a long time to collide because the space is expanding between them. And so then you pass the lifetime at late time. So there's these two parameters, beta and separation, which are important to this. And then there's something which is a bit more, so those two parameters are random sort of quantum. You can put a measure on them, but you can't predict them, because they have to do with where these bubbles appear and when. But then there's some parameters that you could, if you had a model, that you could compute. For example, what happens to this domain wall? Which way does it accelerate? And what you find is that the domain wall always moves away from the bubble that has smaller lambda, basically because it wants to heat up the part of the space that has higher energy. So it will move into a bubble with large lambda. Now, it can happen that it moves away from both bubbles because of curvature. But roughly speaking, it's always true that it moves away from the bubble with smaller lambda. So one thing that means is that if we have a small lambda in our bubble, a small positive lambda, and we collide with a bubble with large positive lambda, the wall is going to accelerate away from us. If we collide with a bubble with negative lambda, then in the approximation that our bubble is flat, then with Horowitz and Schenker showed that if the BGS bound is satisfied by this domain wall, it's still true that the wall will either stay still or move away from us. So in some sense, we're protected from these domain walls, if we believe this bound is satisfied. So that's kind of nice. So most of these walls should, all of them should move away from us.
It doesn't matter what our bubble is like. It only matters what the other bubble is.
No, it matters what our. So if we have a smaller cosmological crust than the other one, then the wall moves away from us. That's what you can say without any caveats.
But I mean, the last bullet point says that if the bubble has negative.
Yeah, you can move away from both. So if what happens if the other bubble has negative sensitivity, it satisfies that bound, then it actually accelerates away from both bubbles. But in particular, it moves away from us.
So okay. You're saying the only dangerous situation is the other bubble has a lambda which is positive but is smaller than ours.
Or if the BPS bound for this domain wall isn't satisfied with the collision with the negative CC bubble. And I'm not sure there's any reason to think it should be. So there might be, but I don't know what it is.
It could be either way. It could be either way. I mean, it could be this type or not.
Right. Yeah. And if it's not,
there's a pretty name here.
If it's not, yeah. That's right. So we're not too excited. But you know, one thing about this is if it does accelerate into our bubble, it very rapidly reaches the speed of light or extremely close to it. And so at least we wouldn't know. So it's not a painful death.
Leaves no grieving survivors behind.
That's right. No warning in the survivor. So, right, okay, so to see what, let's consider a collision where the wall accelerates away from us. It's interesting things for this at least.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
So this is not moving with the speed of light. I mean, that is slower, isn't it?
Yeah, it accelerates with some constant proper acceleration.
So what would be, because I mean, the question is, can light get to us from it? Because it's only slightly slower than the speed of light.
Right, so there's several ways that first of all, light can come to us from the collision event itself, which isn't necessarily moving rapidly in our fan. It could be moving towards us, moving away from us, or not moving. Second of all, if the domain wall, causally it's not disconnected because it's always moving slower than light.
Yeah.
And it may have started off coming towards us and then accelerated away. So there are various ways that we could directly see the domain wall. But it, the most interesting effects, I think, are the ones that result not literally from seeing the domain wall with some luminescence particles, but from the perturbations to the region of space kind of near it. And so I'll describe this in a minute. Okay, right. So let's look a little bit more closely at what kind of signal you might see. Okay, so here's a picture that might help. So we're the observer on this black line, let's say. The green bubble is the bubble that's colliding. I've shifted the coordinates now where we're a vertical dedesic and the other bubble doesn't integrate at the same time. And that blue cone is our past light cone now. And let's say this red cone is the surface of the last scatter, which wouldn't make sense in this picture, but think of that for a second. So when we look at the CMB, what we're seeing is the intersection of our past light cone with the time of last scattering, right? That was a volume at fixed time. So the intersection of a light cone with that is the sphere, and that's the CMB sky. So on this picture, that intersection would be the edge of this blue circle here. And what you can see is that the edge of that blue circle is partly affected because part of it is inside this green cone. So everything here is inside the green cone, inside the light cone of the collision, and partly unaffected because everything over here is outside that light cone. So in other words, the piece of the surface of last scatter that we see, part of it is inside the light cone of the collision and part of it isn't. The part of it that isn't is totally unaffected by the collision, and the part of it that is affected in some way. So in this lower dimensional model, the CMB sky is a circle, and some range of angles is affected by the collision, some range isn't. And so that's, in the real universe, a disk. It says there's a disk on the CMB sky, inside of which there's an effect, and outside of which there isn't. So this is a 1+1-dimensional version of that. This zero sphere is affected, this one isn't. So there's, as I mentioned, you'd see that there's this circle. Part of that circle is affected. So how is it affected? So there are various ways it can be affected, actually. The one that I've concentrated on the most is the following. So in at least in the simplest possible model, the field that tunnels is the inflaton. So for example, in that one scalar field model that I showed before, the field that tunnels is also the field that rolls along that plateau and tracks inflation. And in that case, the domain wall is just, by definition, a particular value of that field. Because when the thing tunnels through, it appears at some point on the potential, and then think of that as the edge of the domain wall. So the domain wall is a boundary condition for the inflaton. It's like putting in an edge to space-time and requiring that the inflaton take some particular value there. And when you do that, you're solving a causal equation, so that only affects the part of the space within the light cone of that surface. But when you do that, the part of the space that is inside that light cone, the level sense of the inflaton will be perturbed from what they otherwise would have been. So you've changed the boundary conditions, and so you've changed the solution. And in particular, if the domain wall, it could either correspond to a boundary condition that's early in inflation, or sort of the left, if the inflaton's rolling to the right, the condition that's to the left, that would hold back inflation and slow it down. Or it could be on the other side, in which case it would accelerate it and speed it up. So in the case where it's holding it back, inflation will end later in that region. And in the case where it's speeding up, it will end earlier. If it ends later, that's a hot spot, and if it ends later, it's a cold spot. So it affects the CMB by changing the temperature of reheating in that region, and therefore by changing the temperature we see in the CMB later on. So that's a bit oversimplified. I assume that there's just one scalar, it's inflaton, et cetera. But in general, these domain walls do serve as boundary conditions on the fields that live in our vacuum, just because the fields that live in our vacuum are relatively low energy compared to what's on the other side. You could consider something more general, but I think that's a pretty reasonable assumption. So anyway, and it gives you an example of the kind of thing that would happen. You get a disk in the sky that has a gradient in the temperature away from what you would have had otherwise. It has a center, which is the direction pointing towards the collision. It has a radius, which is determined by when this collision came into our light cone. And it's either cold or hot, depending on the type of bubble we collided with.
Sorry, Matt. Surface last scattering is defined as a surface of constant temperature at zero. So I'm a bit confused by what you're saying. Are you saying that the perturbations are generated by the effect of this blast, what is this wall after surface last scattering?
So what happens is the redshift, so if you consider a photon that propagates from the surface of the last scattering to us,
So it's kind of like a sex wolf effect.
Yeah, it's like a sex wolf, exactly. Right. So it started off at the same temperature, but it didn't redshift as much because it didn't have to go as far, or it redshifted more because it had to go farther. But it's right. So, I mean, this picture, these lines are, let's say, constant density lines.
I don't think the distance is relevant because, you know, the CMB is formed at a certain temperature, so...
Right, but then the universe expands afterwards, and so the photons that you see are 2.7 degrees Kelvin because the universe is expanded by a lot, right, so you can't see them.
What's expanded by exactly a factor of 1,100?
Exactly, but here...
So it's the same in every direction.
But what's not in this model, because this last scattering is later over here than it is over here. It's just not enough for W cosmology anymore. So it's anisotropic because it's... The symmetry is broken by this collision. So that's actually the calculation that you do. You just calculate the redshift along and LG does a factor less scattering. And it's an angle dependent.
How are you defining surface loss scattering?
Depending on constant temperature.
That's a surface of constant redshift.
It would be in the Fermilion cosmology. It's not in an anisotropic cosmology.
It's the same reason that changing the geometry of the reheating surface causes a temperature fluctuation.
No, I think it's different. You know, we have decoupling exactly at a certain temperature, which defines the redshift. We don't have a distance to the surface loss.
But that's only if I'm not telling you about temperature and redshift are related. In general, temperature and redshift are not related to each other.
So it's like a hot object moving toward you. The temperature you see is not the same as the object. So,
if you're doing a Doppler shift, okay, that's fine, but that's not what's being said, right?
It's both. There's not really a distinction in general relativity, right? You could think of this surface as a Doppler shifted version of this surface. In other words, there's a local frame where this thing is at rest. But in that frame, this thing is in motion. So what you really have to do is compute. You take a co-moving piece of this scattering surface. You compute the redshift from that co-moving object to us as a function of where you are in the scattering surface. That's a function of angle. It's not an isotropic as well.
Does that temperature dependence, is it continuous there, or does it have a kink, or what sort of shape does it have? Thank you.
Right, so in reality, it would be continuous. In this,
is there discontinuity in the slope of the temperature versus angle or something? Or?
Yeah, in this model there is, but that would actually get smoothed out by various effects. For one thing, it gets smoothed out by finite thickness of the surface of mass scattering, but for another, it gets smoothed out. I think it would get smoothed out anyway in space, but at the very least, it's smoothed out at the scale of 1 degree or so by various effects that have to do with the thickness of the surface of mass scattering. Okay, so you asked about seeing the wall itself. I think this is not very likely. First of all, there's no really bright or really cold spot in CMB, and that's what you would expect. But it is kind of an interesting, just fun to think about what would happen. So usually when you have this kind of domain wall that separates, let's say, some region that's at much higher energy from us, our low energy degrees of freedom just bounce off it. They see it as a reflective surface because there's nothing for them to turn into on the other side. So if you have a photon of some reasonable frequency, it can't really pass through the wall very well. There's no mode for it to turn into there. And so this is somewhat model dependent, but I think it's generic that this kind of domain wall is reflective for low energy particles. And so in principle, if you were in the part of the space where you could actually look back and see this domain wall, you would see it as a reflective mirror. But with some Doppler shift. So if it wasn't moving, you would see on the sky a circle where the circles inside that circle are reflective versions of the circle outside it, actually. So inside that disk, you'd be seeing a distorted image of what's outside it. But if it's moving, that distorted image is also Doppler shifted by the reflection, by bouncing up this moving wall. And so if the wall is moving at any significant fraction of the speed of light, it tends to have a very dramatic effect. So unless that's extremely small, unless that disk is very, very small, it's pretty unlikely it's there in the universe. But
so if a human ran into the wall at slow speeds, would he bounce off too?
I guess so. At slow enough speeds, yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Right, okay, so I mentioned some of these parameters already. This slide is maybe redundant. So there's the separation distance between the bubbles, there's the boost of the observer and the frame where the bubbles are at the same time. Then there's the tension of this wall and the energy that's released in the collision. So these things are not computable, you just have to get an expectation value for them. These you can compute given the potential. But there's a lot of work to be done. So the analysis that I've done on collaborators so far, and Anthony and Adam and the collaborators, is, I think, it would be relatively crude in the sense that we've only included some subset of all the possible effects. We haven't, for example, we haven't really solved Einstein's equations even numerically or analytically in this region where the effect is. So we've just done it in some set of approximations. So there's a lot of stuff to do, and it's kind of hard because since the universe is anisotropic, a lot of the standard techniques don't work very well. But anyway, there's a lot to be done. I think this is probably at least, roughly speaking, what one should expect.
So I mean, in actual numerical simulations, the equation is results in a mess, as far as I remember.
Well, sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. It depends a bit on the collection. So if you simulate the collision between two bubbles of the same type, mm-hmm. then there's no topologically stable domain wall. There's nothing that really distinguishes one side from the other. And then the domain wall tends to sort of dissolve into energy. Mm-hmm. And so this is what I'm saying, said here applies only loosely to that case, because there's not a well-defined domain wall. So that should really be everyone separate. But when the two bubbles are at different types, and when there's a large difference in cosmological constant, you do tend to have a pretty thin wall separating them. And it accelerates one way or the other. So in that case, it's not such a mess. And there is energy that gets released, and that's part of what leads to these things. But, so, yeah, I mean, it's but the American simulations are very valuable here, because these analytic solutions really don't go, they're not general enough. You might also wonder about multiple collisions. I think unless you're lucky or unlucky, and three bubbles all collide at the same moment at the same point, it's not that difficult to analyze the case of multiple collisions, because by the time these light cones overlap, the effects are relatively weak, and you can use a linear approximation. But still, it's not something you can do analytically. So. Okay, so what are some of the other effects that you might look for? One of the kind of interesting ones is that since the universe is no longer isotropic, there isn't a fixed rest frame anymore. And so in a standard FOW cosmology structure, large scale structures like galaxy clusters should be at rest on average in the CMB rest frame. So if you computed their or measured their velocity and averaged it over a Hubble volume, you should get something that's very close to zero. And in this case, you don't, because one part of our Hubble volume has been affected by this light cone, and if you heated, so to speak, in a frame that's at rest, that is not at rest in the frame that the rest of it is at rest in. So in other words, there's some sort of net velocity difference between these two parts of the Hubble volume. And so when you measure the peculiar velocity of galaxy clusters and take its average, you shouldn't get zero. And you should get something which has a particular pattern to it. So there should be a velocity that's sort of maximized in the same direction that you have this polar hotspot, and then decreases as you move away from it. So that's interesting, because there was a claim that something like that actually exists, which I'll mention at the end. But anyway, it's one of the things you could look for. So I think the polarization of CMB photons would be affected, and that's something that I want to look at more closely. And then, yes, it's much more about it. It might be that the wall emits radiation you could detect directly, not by its effects on the CMB, but really directly. I think this is relatively unlikely. So one interesting feature of these collisions is that because of this SO2,1 invariance, because there's a unique solution to Einstein's equations up to one parameter, there can't be any gravitational radiation, because there's no room for any other solution. So unless that symmetry is broken, which of course will be by quantum fluctuations, but that's a second order effect, unless the symmetry is broken, there won't be a lot of gravitational wave emission in just a single collision. Still, there might be enough to be interesting in some cases. So it's remains to be seen which effect is the most important. Okay, so just to summarize, the one thing that ties together all of these effects is that they're all of sort of L equals zero type. They're not literally dipoles, because the functional dependence is not a dipole dependence, but they're monotonic functions of the angle from some axis. So the effect generally is maximized that way and then decreases. Okay, taking into account some second order effects, there can be wiggles in this function, but ask me afterwards. In general, they're monotonic. On sufficiently large scales, at least they're monotonic. So that's one thing that can
happen. M equals zero?
Sorry?
What do you call it, like M equals zero? What is that?
Oh, I'm sorry, M equals one. Mm-hmm. M equals one.
But
it's like a dipole. There's a direction, and then there's a dependence just on angle from that direction. So you don't have oscillations.
But if it's a small thing
yes.
in the sky, it wouldn't contribute to like L equals, or to only the small L's of the CMB.
Yes.
Those aren't the L's you're talking about.
It's not literally, I'm just saying it's a monotonic function of angle. So.
Okay.
air conditioning. That's all I think. That's all I think. And then that equals one. Okay, so this is all great. If there's a collision, there's all these interesting facts, et cetera. But as we've been thinking, why is it there? Because as we all know, the decay rate for these things is exponentially suppressed in some instant dot action. So it's an extremely rare process. And so therefore, there's probably zero in our class light cone, and we'll only see them if we wait for another 100 million years or whatever. And so why should we care about this? But that's not. So to really answer that question requires some careful analysis. It's not as simple as it is up here. And so let's see how that works. Okay, so here's a cartoon of a conformal diagram for this process. So if you impose an initial condition surface, it doesn't have to be on the whole universe, it just has to be in some volume a little bigger than the Hubble volume, so this part of the space expands. Then every now and then a bubble will appear. And bubbles of different types can appear, so different colors are. The time that it takes depends on this decay rate, which as I said is typically exponentially small. And as you move further and further out in this conformal diagram, there's a warp factor in this metric, which gets very large near the top. So in other words, there's a lot of physical time sandwiched into this infinitesimal interval up here. So there's more and more and more of these bubbles that form as you move higher up in the diagram, but they get smaller in the sense that they occupy less and less of future infinity. And that's where these distributions come from that have the scale invariance. So you map onto that, you slice it in the infinite future, contains more and more bubbles of smaller and smaller size. But anyway, as you can see, these things will collide with ours. And so what we want to know is how many collisions to expect today. And one thing that's going to be very important is whether the cosmological constant in our bubble is equal to the cosmological constant out here, or whether it's smaller than it, or I suppose larger. If it's equal, then the conformal diagram has a horizontal line, because there's not really a distinction between the inside and the outside. So in other words, the infinitely inflated future inside the bubble is just the same as the one outside. And so you have a horizontal line capping off this bubble. If it's zero, if you have a Minkowski bubble, then you have this kind of hat, this Minkowski hat, which has a null boundary. And if it's something between zero and the value here, then you have a sort of ice cream cone shape. You have this kind of bulge. That is an invariant statement about a conformal diagram in the sense that if you tried to change coordinates where this was straight, then something weird would happen to the rest of it, and down or something like that. So a small cosmological constant gives you a bigger region to live in up here. So if you want to count the expected number of these collisions that's in our past, what we should do is compute the four volumes in our past light cone today, or whatever we're interested in answering this question, and multiply it by the decay rate per unit time per unit volume, and that will give us the expected number of bubbles that we've created in our past. So Guthrie and Palenkin, in a very nice paper, analyzed this problem a couple of years ago, and they treated this case, just for simplicity, where the cosmological constant inside the bubble is the same as it was out, so this is the appropriate conformal diagram. This is the r equals 0 axis of symmetry of the bubble. So the light cone of somebody up here, after infinite time, is this triangle here. And these different colored regions, you generally want to assume that there are no bubble nucleations in the past light cone of your own bubble's nucleation, because you're interested in a bubble nucleation in the false vacuum. So there can't have been just by consistency a nucleation in here, because then Mars wouldn't have... we'd be analyzing a different problem. So you exclude this blue region, the past light cone of the nucleation points. And then this initial condition, which I drew on this diagram here, you have a choice of initial conditions. The simplest one is to pick t equals minus infinity in the flat slicing consider, and it's not going to matter very much which one we pick, but that's the one that they considered, and so here it is. It's this dashed line, that's t equals minus infinity in the flat slicing. And so this being in the false vacuum means you don't consider any bubbles that appear down here because they can't affect anything. And so what's left is this green volume. The green volume is the volume in which if bubbles nucleated, they would collide with us and affect us. And of course, this whole thing is rotated, so that's the shape that you get by subtracting two cones. Okay, so fine. So we can compute that green volume. But one question we should worry about, one thing we should worry about is, I mentioned that inside one of these bubbles, there's this FRW slicing, these slices like this. And because it's FRW, at least if you don't worry about collisions yet, everybody inside the bubble It's co-moving in those coordinates is equivalent. They're all, they're just like observers at different places in flat slicing. To get from one observer to another, to translate along those FRW slices, is a boost around this point. An open universe, its invariance is a 3-1. So you boost around this point. It's the Lorentz group around this point. And that will take you from, say, this observer to one over here. So what happens to this picture when you do that? What happens is that nothing happens inside the bubble because it has an invariance, but the initial condition surface that you picked is not invariant under this boost, and so it's affected. And in particular, if you make an infinite boost, and in some sense that's generic because these slices are hyperbolic, so all of the volume is at the boundary, so you should probably make a very large boost away from wherever you started. That's where almost everybody lives. And if you make an infinite boost, you end up with something which is quite anisotropic. This black part is excluded by the initial condition, which is now this line. And so you only have this region. And in fact, since this region has touched the bottom, it has a divergent volume. And so you end up with a situation where all the collisions come basically from one direction. It's not actually infinitely anisotropic, but it's quite anisotropic for this observer. So that's not actually so bad. It just would say, not really right idea, it would just say that there's a anisotropic distribution even of these collisions. But it's a little weird because it depended on the initial condition, and it remains even after a large time. So they call this the persistence of memory. It turns out, one thing that's important to note, and I'll have a picture that shows this a little bit more clearly, is that the distribution is anisotropic, but it gets less anisotropic as time goes on. So if you think about bubble collisions that happen very late, the distribution is less anisotropic than it is for the ones that happened early. However, if you have the same cosmological constant inside the bubble as you do outside, so you have this kind of feature, you don't get to see very late collisions, because very late collisions only affect this corner of the bubble, so you don't get to see them. So the part of the distribution that you see is quite anisotropic. That's why there's this anisotropy. And what's actually more important for my purposes is that if you compute the volume, either in these two, well, let's say in these two green regions here, the answer is of order one in units of the false vacuum Hubble constant. It's h false vacuum minus 4. If you multiply that by the k rate per unit time per unit volume, that tells you the expected number. And since the k rate per unit time per unit volume is exponentially small, the expected number of bubbles that could nucleate in these two green regions is an exponentially small number. So it doesn't look very encouraging. But both of these problems, or both of these facts, both the anisotropy and the fact that there are a small number of bubbles that should be in a fast light cone, are changed dramatically if you don't assume that the cosmological constant inside the bubble is equal to the one outside. And in particular, so this just shows why it's the early bubbles that are affected by the initial condition and why you have an anisotropy there. This initial condition surface, if you view it from above, it looks like that. So big disks, which are early collisions, can't cross this line, and so they're sort of strongly affected by it. They only can appear over here. But very small disks like this one can appear at almost any angle. They can fit into this sort of crack here. And so very late collisions, if you could see them, wouldn't look very anisotropic. And in fact, you can see them if you live in a bubble with small cosmological constant, because now you can see these very small collisions that occur up here instead of only the ones that occur down here. So a little bit of time. So one of the facts then of allowing for a very small cosmological constant in our bubble is that you get to see these late-time bubble collisions, and these late-time bubble collisions are actually isotropic. You might not care that much about that, because again, what really matters is what the total number is. So you can also compute the total number, and it turns out it's much larger, simply because this green region now extends almost all the way up to this point. So remember, there's this conformal factor that goes to infinity here, and so if you can see this little corner, you can see much more volume than if you can't. It contains an infinite amount of volume, actually, in this little corner. If you really lived in the Minkowski bubble, you could see it. That means at infinite time for a Minkowski observer, you see an infinite number of bubbles. If you have just a small cosmological constant, it's not quite an infinite number, but it's still pretty large because you're getting this piece up here. So the number of bubble collisions in your past light cone is going to be much bigger once you take into account the fact that the cosmological constant inside the bubble is small. Okay, so, right. So what's the answer? So how many collisions do you expect in your best? It's gamma, which is this decay rate per unit time per unit volume in the false vacuum, so something exponentially small, times Vf, Vf means the vacuum energy of the false vacuum, divided by Vi. So Vi is actually the vacuum energy during inflation in our bubble. If you didn't have any inflation, this formula would be different. But like I said, you have to have inflation to get something, to get any kind of sensible cosmology. So if you did have inflation during your bubble, it turns out that it's the inflationary vacuum energy that, that controls this phenomenon, not the dark energy today. So this ratio is probably very large. If you assume that Vf is of order of the Planck scale, or at least somewhere near the fundamental scale.
Don't you have the arbitrary boost factor that you can go from 1 to infinity?
Yeah, I skipped over one thing. It turns out that taking something into account that I'll explain, if you want, it's almost invariant. It, it doesn't depend on the boost. It's almost completely independent of the boost. And if you do a different boost, it's perfect. So, yeah.
And this gap, this rate of bubble up speed per four volume of something, of
false back.
Of false back.
Yeah.
Why is Vf over Vi large?
So Vf is the vacuum energy of the false vacuum.
Right. So I have false vacuum and a barrier and then slow rolls.
Right.
And I is calculated there because at the bubble of pH.
Oh, so yeah, Vi is calculated during inflation. Not at the point that the field appears, but at the point where it slow rolls. Basically because
that sort of falls away, right? It changes.
It changes a little bit, yeah. So you can make this formula more exact if you want. For example, in a slow roll expansion, there'd be epsilon or eta corrections too. But the reason is
that 6 e foldings, the first few e foldings, the V over the FVI would be order 1.
No.
Actually not. So
the N,
because it's a cobbing.
We know that this can't be.
I agree with you, so.
But the Golgi normalization isn't that's much later. That's
no, it's 60. It's 60 foldings
right
before the end of inflation.
So if I start there.
If you start there, you have to start with Vf over Vi 10 to the 12th. No, but this ratio has nothing to do with slow roll.
But if there wasn't slow roll, this would be the right answer. So it does in that sense. It's just that when the field first tunnels, it doesn't inflate immediately because it's curvature dominated. So what happens in these potentials is it falls down very rapidly, rapidly as the universe only expands by a factor of 2 or something.
And then
it reaches this plateau. And it's the V on that plateau that matters, and that's the V that we have an experiment constraint on from the lack of tensor mode fluctuations. So, right, so this number, if Vf is near the Planck scale, can't be any smaller than about 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 12.
I don't understand. So Va is not the resin for moving the Planck scale?
No, it's the maximum during the question. So I is for inflation. The reason that matters is because once the bubble starts to inflate, almost all the collisions take place during the period after the bubble appears and before it starts to really inflate. So they actually, all these collisions take place during the curvature dominating phase. And the reason for that is that what matters here is the conformal time. And during inflation, very little conformal time passes. But during the phase of curvature domination, a lot of conformal time passes.
Suppose there is no conformal inflation.
Okay, then this answer is not correct. So.
But still, if Va is very small, you would see lots of bubbles.
Yeah, that's true, but it's not the same original form. So in that case,
that would be our vacuum energy there.
Well, if we ended up inflating, if there's no inflation, but we have a vacuum energy which is given by Vi, then yeah, that's right. That Vi would be the one we have today. But if there was a period of slow roll inflation in our past, it's not the vacuum energy today that matters. It's the vacuum energy during inflation that matters. And it's a pretty simple explanation. It just has to do with the amount of conformal time that passes between.
I can understand that this will be the number, say, in a curvature region. So, and for that reason, inflation is important.
Right.
Yeah, maybe.
Exactly. And since we haven't been curvature dominated ever since then,
okay,
very little conformal time has passed. That's if we became curvature dominated again at wait times, you'd have to correct this. No, it's not very complicated, but there's an additional term. Okay, so great. So how big can this number be? So this is probably a large number. Yam, on the other hand, is probably certainly a very small number, an exponentially small number like that. But the action that appears there is not likely to be larger than this, because that's the action for a sort of Hawking-Moss coupling. That's the action to just go all the way to the top of the barrier and then fall off. And Kolmogorov is more efficient than that, at least in regime dynamics. So it's unlikely that the action is any bigger than this. And so that sort of puts a lower bound on gamma. And so if this VF is not too far from the Planck scale, this product can be quite large, actually, without any particular Planck tuning.
So Matt?
Yeah.
But there's a 24 pi square that multiplies that, which is really important.
Because you've got e to the minus, even if that's 1. So even if I grant you that this is Coleman Deluce, no gravity, that's not important, and you have the maximal sort of thing if everything is just set by the Planck scale.
Yes.
And you still got the 24 pi square.
You're talking about Hawking Moss, or you're talking about Coleman
Deluce? So the Hawking Moss is you got the 24 pi square thing.
Maybe VF can be equal to 24 pi squared.
What's that?
Maybe VF can be 24 pi squared.
but like the order one factors are really important.
Very important.
So you got exponential.
But this is an upper bound on this. Coleman Deluce is generally much more efficient than that. So for example, if the barrier is thin for some reason, it can be extremely efficient. It doesn't depend on the height.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's I mean the other thing to remember is that what matters here is the fastest decay rate.
Right.
So if you live in a landscape with a huge number of vacua, you have a huge number of accessible decay rates, and it's pretty hard to estimate what the fastest one is going to be. Probably some NP complete problem, but anyway, it's likely to be a lot faster than the generic. Anyway, I don't know, but I don't think it doesn't require any particularly small parameter or large parameter to get this to be bigger than one. This actually isn't really the end of the story. You should be suspicious of this because, as I said at the beginning, lots of inflation should remove all such signals. There shouldn't be able to see signatures in the initial state if you have a lot of inflation. And at least one of the ways that happens in this model is that very early collisions that happens very early on in the universe, have a light cone which sort of swallows up the entire left scattering surface, the entire part of it that we can see. And I don't have a very good picture for that, but if you imagine a collision which took place down here, so what the person at B can see is the intersection of their past light cone with his left scattering surface, that's some finite segment of it. And a collision that happened very early would completely encompass that segment and more. Okay, so in other words, you don't see, you just see what you can see. You just see the part of the left scattering surface that's accessible to us now, not the whole thing. And a very early collision would eat up the whole thing. And there are pretty good reasons to think that if you live in a universe like that one, you don't see anything particularly unusual. FRW symmetry is restored, so Matt and David have argued this. And I think the best way to think about it really is that a very early collision is like a collision that happens and really swallowed up the whole bubble entirely. And then it's just like you started from a different false vacuum. So you should sort of reset your clock. You shouldn't include these very early collisions. They just don't have an effect on any physics. So we shouldn't include collisions that happen so early that they are much larger than the sky. And so we might want to restrict to collisions whose light cones intersect the part of the last scattering surface that we can see. That means that the disk they make on the sky has a radius, an angular radius somewhere between very small and the whole sky. So we should restrict to those collisions. So what's the answer to do that? It's actually quite simple. It just multiplies the previous result by the square root of omega k, where omega k is the curvature contribution to omega Coleman Quebec. Okay, so we know experimentally that omega k is less than or of order about 0.01, so its square root is less than about 0.1. So the experimental constraint on omega k is not very severe. And theoretically, we know that omega k scales like this. So this n naught, this e to the n naught, is related to the expansion between the end of inflation and now. During that expansion, curvature gets more and more important, so that's why it's plus sign. This number depends on the reheating temperature, it depends on various parameters that are extremely badly constrained, but in some sort of simplest possible model, it's more 60 or 62 or something. So anyway, there's this factor here, and then this n had better be larger than n0, because if it isn't, we would see curvature of order 1 today. So we know n is bigger than n0. But as you can see, if it's too much larger, then there's an exponential decrease in this thing. It just says that the universe, the curvature gets inflated away exponentially by inflation. And therefore, all of these interesting effects do as well. So like every other effect that has to do with the state and the very early universe, long inflation gets rid of it. And how bad that is, again, something that we really can't answer. One thing we can say is that it's very difficult to get long inflation in string theory. It's very difficult even to get enough equals to solve the Lattice problem. Perhaps there's a measure that favors minimal inflation, On the other hand, there's an entropy constraint that tells you you should have had at least enough folds to get away to get rid of the curvature that I mentioned before. So it might not be unreasonable to think that the inflation wasn't too much longer than necessary to solve the flatness problem. But I don't think we can really say that with much confidence. That's probably the biggest uncertainty. If there was 1,000 folds of inflation, forget it. Even if there was 100, forget it. So that's that vacuum sitting there. Okay, so just as a sort of teaser, there are a couple of interesting anomalies in current data. And with a student at NYU and Olivia Doré, I'm currently looking at CMB data to try to match this pattern that you obtain from small inclusions. It's a specific pattern, and you can look for it in the data. So I suspect that that search is going to find this cold spot, which is a pretty well-known feature. In the CMB, it's anomalously cold. It's roughly 10 degrees across, and there it is. I guess the question to answer will be how significant it is, and I don't know the answer to that yet. There's also, as I mentioned before, a paper that claims to have observed they call it dark flows. In other words, that the average killer velocity of galaxy clusters in some big sample, looking at most of the Hubble volume, isn't zero, and points in some direction. It's very statistically significant. I think there's a lot of debate about their statistical analysis. A lot of people don't think they did it correctly, so it may be that this will go away. But it is out there. So there are some interesting hints in the data, but I don't think they're very, they're certainly not conclusive in any way at the moment. Okay, so I'll just conclude. Hopefully this isn't coming. So I think there's kind of a really unique opportunity here, which we may or may not live at the right time to take advantage of. It turns out to be a pretty rich problem. It leads to these kinds of global field theories, as well as these interesting effects in cosmology and a way to make anisotropic cosmologies. I think the expected number of collisions in our past may be larger than one, and that doesn't require any fine tuning. And whether there's any real connection, I should probably say that it flows, or it's the cold spot is done enough, but in progress. So thank you.
So there's kind of an interesting, actually very optimistic scenario. So see, you know that the number of collisions you expect depends on this ratio of the scale of inflation to the Pulse vacuum scale. So let's make the scale of inflation really low, okay? So that maximizes the number you'd expect. And also, because you have the bubble, you don't really have to solve homogeneity, horizon, all these problems with standard cosmology. So you need many fewer u-folds than you may naively think you would, because you just need to solve the flatness problem. And so by lowering the scale of inflation, you lower the reheating temperature, which decreases the number of u-folds you need to solve the flatness problem. So actually, you could get away with 38 u-folds of inflation and maximize the number. So anyway.
Okay.
For an optimistic note, that's kind of.
I mean, I don't think it matters. Like the number of e-folds by itself isn't really that important because it's always this ratio that appears. But I agree that if you can lower the initial holding that fixed, or sorry, the inflation holding that fixed, you could.
But then you might expect these other effects could be larger than you think because you don't have to loon by 60 volt inflation, but maybe just 30.
It could be. Yeah. For example, direct radiation from the thing would be easier to see.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
These bubble collisions are also you have these domain walls which are crossing this surface of last scattering bit. So if you put that all in, does that actually mean that this hypersurface instead of where a real last scattering without being hit by a domain wall is really finite? It isn't infinite. Does that mean each bubble has a finite expected three volume at last scattering?
So that's a very good question, and the answer is no. So what happens is if you look down on that surface from above. It would have been some kind of circle. This is a pulsar disk.
Right.
And these domain walls take bites out of it, which is something like this. And they only leave a fractal set on this matrix. So they leave a set of measure zero at the bottom here. But even though it's a set of measure zero, when you take into account the measure that comes from the metric on it, so there's some measure zero, flat metric.
Flat, yeah.
You take into account the hyperbolic metric, they're all falling again.
Awesome.
So even though it's a Cantor dust in this picture, everybody lives in one of those regions there. So.
So you have to assume this initial time surface, right? So you're cutting off your disappearance space. And that breaks the symmetry, so 3-1 symmetry.
Right.
So then are you really solving the homogeneity and isotropy problem?
You can ask the question about any question at all. I mean, I think, I'm not sure whether this has anything particularly interesting to say about
but
that.
I just wonder how isotropic the distribution of bubbles is going to be.
Oh, no, it ends up being almost perfectly isotropic. And that's related to the fact that, I skipped over something when I was describing this measure. Basically, in order to find an isotropic distribution, you need a way of excluding these very large bubbles. And one physical way to do that is to notice that since the domain walls sort of eat up part of the space, and presumably we don't live in a part of the space that, if we traced our trajectory back, wouldn't intersect one of those domain walls. If we impose that condition, then at least in the approximation to how these domain walls move, you exclude this red region. And this red region is the region that contains all of the divergence because it appears down here on this corner. So in other words, if you put in a pretty physical constraint, which is that we didn't reheat to the future of one of the domain walls, you end up finding, you get rid of almost all the anisotropy. Because in here, these are late-time bubbles, and the late-time bubbles are hardly affected at all by the initial condition surface. It's related to the conversation that was going on during Ben's talk yesterday, which is that in the ultraviolet of this conformal field theory, all effect of the initial conditions is gone, and in fact, you can remove the initial condition surface entirely without affecting the CFT at all, or hardly at all.
And the big bubbles, you don't care about them.
You don't in the CFT because you study infrared-safe quantities. Perhaps we don't here because we couldn't live in regions that are affected by them. So some of this.
So it doesn't stop your theory from possibly predicting most of them like that. You're just not trying to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could try to base a measure on this set of ideas, and well, that's what we're talking about. Possible. It may work, but I don't have much to say about it right now.
But see, also that the curvature you predict to be negative from this ball, I mean, is that a generic thing from internal inflation? Either you expect it to be unobservable, I mean, in other words, less than the cosmic variance, or negatively curved, or does internal inflation allow?
I think if you have a slow roll internal inflation, you don't expect the universe to be FRW at all on large scales. And on intermediate scales, you expect it to look very flat, simply because there was a lot of ordinary inflation, generally speaking, after the end of the internal inflating regime. So if you could look at margin of scales, you can just see huge density perturbations, and there's no preferred FRW slicing, so you can't really define the spatial curvature. So
right.
Spatial curvature can only be defined as long as it's larger than delta rho over rho on the appropriate scale. And it never is in internal inflation. So I think internal inflation just doesn't give you FRW cosmology success in small pieces where that's a normal inflation after. This bubble nucleation gives you negatively curved things. So what seems to be hard to get in this class of models is positive curvature. You can get it maybe by Hawking asymptotes, but not by this kind of tunnel.
You can get it from cosmic variance. You could have
Delta
rho over rho, which is big for some reason, on
large scale. That's true. So in an internally inflated, slow roll internally inflated universe, you might, by some incredibly unlikely chance, find a region that happens to be smooth and have average curvature that's positive. That's always possible.
But it's not very unlikely. 10 to the minus 5 is.
No. It's incredibly unlikely. It's the exponential of that.
So 10 to the minus 5 is what we know is that spectrum on horizon scale today. But on larger scale, the spectrum could have much bigger fractures. The delta rho over rho could have much bigger fractures.
Right, but what you would need to get something that was approximately FRW is something which is extremely homogeneous, but all those fluctuations have conspired to make something that looks like it has positive curvature. And if you estimate the probability of that, it's something like e to the 10 to the 5.
Right, that depends on what delta rho, what is the power of spectrum, right?
No, but during internal inflation, it's order 1. We can talk about that, but I think it requires some, it's possible, it's certainly possible, but it's exponentially unlikely. Because it requires a whole series of coincidences everywhere within the Hubble body.
But I think you can cook up a slow roll inflation, and that's after internal inflation is over.
Right.
Delta rho over rho is arbitrarily large. But not less than 1, but it's bigger than 10 to the minus 5, but 10 to the minus 2 on super horizon.
If delta rho over rho is So the weight scales is e to the minus 1 over delta rho over rho. So if delta rho over rho in some universe was 10 to the minus 2, then it would be unlikely at the level e to the minus 100. 10 to the minus 5, it's unlikely.
But we know delta rho over rho.
We know what delta rho over rho is, right?
But we know it only at for short fitment, for horizon escape.
That's what we're talking about, the curvature on the horizon.
The point is you want to get a universe like ours.
You could have an infinitely long wavelength mode, I don't know, 100 times Hubble escape. It's delta rho over rho is 10 to the minus 2. And there's nothing
that's not going to lead to a large observable curvature on
it. It does. It gives you k of, it gives you only a k of 10 to the minus 2. That's
what it is. Remember, guys, comes into this discussion over lunch. And so let's thank you.